Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Norma Walden, Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum. We welcome our audience here and on radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker today, Paul Clark, PhD, is an adjunct instructor with the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey at its U.S. Air Force Command and Staff College and its Center for Civil-Military Relations. His teaching areas include strategy, war theory, cross-cultural studies, intelligence, and international relations. He is a retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel who served in intelligence and academic positions from 1987 to 2007, including two tours at the National Security Council staff at the White House, culminating as the Assistant Press Secretary for Foreign Affairs. His final deployment was in a senior intelligence position at the Coalition Air Operations Center, overseeing operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. So you see, he knows something about intelligence procedures. Let's welcome Dr. Paul Clark to tell us about myths and the U.S. intelligence community.
Thank you, Norma. And she failed to mention, I did ask her, but I've been a member of the Commonwealth Club for more than 10 years, so it's a very powerful and important organization. And we have a good turnout today. I also want to give you some ideas of what I'm going to be talking about. These are my basic theses about the fact that there's sort of an inherent secrecy in intelligence. That leads to some problems with public perception. Most of the time, I'm going to be talking about popular images and the myths that are created. And then lastly, I'm going to give you some ideas about expectation and failures and what to view the intelligence community. I did work for the Air Force for 20 years. I was an Air Force officer. That was my first job. My job in the Air Force was largely intelligence. I did other things, including teaching. I no longer have a security clearance. I have no relationship with an intelligence community. I didn't work for the CIA. I worked for the Air Force. I did intelligence work for the Air Force. So I have a sort of an insider's view, but I also have some separation between myself and the intelligence community. I'm someone who has some ideas and respect for it, and I know some secrets, but I'm certainly not going to tell any of them today. So I want to present some ideas. I don't want to give you a gloss over the intelligence community. I'm going to give you some ideas to think about the nature of the intelligence community. This is one of my heroes, Harry Truman. He's holding up some really bad intelligence there. Dewey defeats Truman. And then he's really asking in this lineup here, he's asking for, give me a one-handed economist. All my economists, they say on the one hand, on the other. He is actually asking for very bad analysis there. And you could just put the word intelligence analyst instead of economist, and you'd have a recipe for disaster. Talk about disasters. What is that image? I'm going to come back to it. I'm going to make sense of that image by the end of this presentation. By the way, as we go through it, if you have a question you need to ask, please raise your hand and I'll clarify it. I'm going to be going through a lot of these wonderful slides, and some of them may not spark the reaction I think they would. They will, so here we go. Okay, I'm going to deal with some what I call myths or realities. I'm not going to judge it. I'm going to put out some perspective on it, and I want you to make your own judgment. The first one is there such a thing as the intelligence community? The first thing we think of when we think of the intelligence community, we think of that organization, the CIA. That's the one we're most familiar with, created in 1947. But really, there are 16 organizations in the intelligence community, the CIA being one of them. And at the top of that is the Director of National Intelligence, who's about to be replaced, Dennis Blair. He has his own organization that has several hundred people in it. So really, 17 organizations. Of those, the ones I just highlighted are part of the Department of Defense. Okay, so their primary job is intelligence. They report to someone whose primary job is not intelligence. That is to say, if you're the director of National Security Agency, your job is intelligence, but you report to someone whose job isn't intelligence. Same thing with the FBI intelligence unit, or Homeland Security, or Coast Guard. Department of Energy, why do they have intelligence? well, they do our nukes. They do our nuclear weapons. Matter of fact, if you look at it, there's only one agency and that whole lot who does intelligence, reports to someone who does intelligence or is an intelligence consumer, and it's the CIA. So maybe the homespun conclusion that the CIA equals U.S. intelligence community has some validity, but it's a lot more nuanced than that. For example, if you're in the FBI, your use of intelligence is quite a bit different than the use of intelligence in the CIA. The type of intelligence you generate is very different. And you may ask, why is so much of it in the Department of Defense? Why all these agencies in the Department of Defense have intelligence? Because there's a feeling that intelligence should be close to the warfighter, because a warfighter needs quick intelligence. That's the rationale. But it does mean that the Department of Defense has much bigger budget in intelligence than the CIA, according to public figures. Okay, so second myth, intelligence is all about spying. And this is part of the popular perception, so I think problematic. Anybody remember The Man from U.N.C.L.E.? That's the one I grew up on. By the way, my girlfriend told me I look like Sean Connery, and I was quite happy. And then I realized she was thinking of the Sean Connery from the Indiana Jones movie, who was a 6-year-old father of Harrison Ford, and not wearing his toupee anymore. But I think it's problematic that we view the intelligence community as being mostly consistent of this type of character, particularly with Jack Bauer type of character from the 24 series, which I refuse to watch. It's even so common that we have these stooge spies, and the thing they have in common is they always win. By the way, the fellow who played Maxwell Smart, Don Adams, was a Marine who was injured at Guadalcanal World War II, and then became a drill instructor in the Marine Corps. Sometimes the reality is a lot better than the myth. And then we also have these two-dimensional enemies. So not only do we always win, but the enemies that we come up against are often, not always, they're two-dimensional. That's to say, we perceive them as being fairly easy to defeat or having a fatal flaw, and you just need to find out what that is. He doesn't like green toothpaste. Aha, now we have him. I mean, it's essentially that simple. And quite often, the fellow from the super spy is doing his own intelligence work. Not only is he a covert agent, but he's also doing his own analysis on the fly. Pretty cool, but not very realistic. This is what most of our people in the intelligence community, it's about 100,000 people in the federal government, most of them wear a uniform, about half, more than half. The other 40,000 are civilians. And then we have another 20 to 30,000, depending upon how you count them and what source you believe, of contractors who do it. So even then, still the majority of our folks in intelligence are working technical types of intelligence, not spying, per se, not doing human intelligence. By the way, you can find out a lot about the intelligence agencies by going out to their websites. These are unclassified websites. Just type in NSA.gov, and each of them has a kids page. There's one for the CIA, NSA. The Counterterrorism Center even has a kids page. They're really trying really hard to get the fact out there that they are above board organizations, whether you subscribe to that or not. Okay, I'm just going to shift gears a little bit. This is a myth reality that's been really prevalent since 9/11, and it's often said, hey, this is the solution to our problems with intelligence. We need to have better human intelligence. But I would point out it's a lot harder than we think. For example, this fellow Curveball on the left, you may remember from the Iraq War, was the fellow who told us that there was these mobile chemical laboratories. Well, it turns out he was quite insane and not truthful, both those things. And then the fellow Ahmed Chalabi, who was the DOD's candidate to be the future leader of Iraq, turned out to have too many ties to Iran, was passing intelligence to Iran, and giving us some bad scoop. In fact, if you think about the way it works in intelligence in human, during the Cold War, we had a natural interface with our main enemy, the Soviet Union, and its bloc. We were in their country, they were in our country to some degree, and we were all in neutral countries. We had embassies, and those embassies had folks, and we had trade groups, and we had businessmen. I mean, academicians could have filled this role, but we don't have that sort of interface with the enemies we face now, at least not the non-state enemies like Al-Qaeda. You're not going to meet them. I've never worn a white tux and gone to a ball to meet meet somebody. It's just not going to happen in the current environment. I think it's a noble goal to increase human intelligence. It's a huge challenge. And the other thing we think about intelligence, we think about that 24 phenomenon. It's all about covert action. Well, covert action is something that's done by a lot of different agencies. Even the local governments do covert actions, the police actions that can be covert. Department of Defense does covert actions. In our system, we have covert actions. It's part of the overt description of the mission for the CIA. There's no secret about it, but it doesn't mean it necessarily has to be there. It's one of the functions they perform. But the core function of intelligence to gather information and come with assessments is not necessarily related to this concept of covert action. That is an additional type of function that we've done in intelligence over the years. We all tracking? This one was big in the 70s. The CIA is a rogue elephant, and you recall this fellow, Senator Church, and his committee, and Representative Pike, they had a committee, and they discovered that our intelligence organizations and also intelligence organizations within the military had done some pretty bad things to our own citizens. They also conducted operations outside the U.S., which generally were not viewed in much favor, including assassinations attempts and covert actions and whatnot. And it was a big scandal, and this is right along the same time we had Watergate and the drawdown from Vietnam. It was just a bad time for the U.S. government. We never recovered our legitimacy. But it did lead us to the conclusion that the CIA is a rogue elephant. And I would suggest to you that the evidence is probably a little bit more fuzzy. Right after these things came about, we elected Jimmy Carter president. He put in a fellow here, Stansfield Turner, who was an admiral in the Navy and became the director of CIA. And it went systematically about getting rid of covert actions, reducing human intelligence, and getting out of the dirtier businesses we were in. He's still someone who's very reviled by certain aspects of the intelligence community because he dismantled so much of what they did. But then we had President Reagan and that fellow who's laughing is his campaign manager, Casey. He's also his director of Central Intelligence, a former OSS, a precursor to the CIA fellow. And they brought back some of these capabilities as part of their strategy of undermining the Soviet Union was to fund things like the Contras in Nicaragua and to beef up support for the government in El Salvador to make the Soviets bleed. Same with Afghanistan. So you could see that really it's the executive has a lot of say over what's happening within the community. It's not simply there are a lot of rogue elephants out there. It's what we decide to do, what you decide to do, who you elect, and how it plays out. I did this lecture a couple of years ago, and this is a new one. This is Robert Gates. He's my former boss on the White House staff. And there's a very unhappy-looking Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld getting his highest civilian award. Gates replaced Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld is generally considered among the members of the military not to have been very successful. One would have to wonder why. He had been chief of staff of the White House. He had been an elected representative. He had been a very successful businessman. He had been a reservist in the Navy, a pilot for many years. He had also been the Secretary of Defense once before, so he knew the job. But he left it with some disgrace. And he was replaced by Robert Gates, a career intelligence guy. And there's sort of an underlying idea we have about intelligence personnel that they must be idiots because, you know, you have to connect the dots. If they're not connecting dots, they're pretty stupid. But this guy, Secretary Gates, is clearly not. He's a fellow who rose up through intelligence community and now is not only doing a good job, depending upon how you weigh these things, but certainly doing better than his predecessor and was kept on with the Obama administration. By the way, he's one of the few folks who's actually doing something which we don't do much of, and that is punishing senior leaders who don't do their jobs right. This is the Secretary of the Air Force and the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. You recall there was an incident where some nuclear weapons were shipped across the country with off the proper documentation. We didn't know they were gone, essentially. Secretary Gates fired both the civilian and the military heads of the Air Force. Uh, 9/11 and Iraq WMD were intelligence failures. Okay, that's not a myth. That's actually quite true. There's a lot of nuance in there. Well, the 9/11, we failed to provide the adequate warning that there was going to be an attack. WMD is a little more complex because you have to parse out WMD. The intelligence community never said there were nuclear weapons, but they certainly thought there were chemical weapons. But my point here is that it's more than just that. It's what the operators, the policymakers, the folks who use intelligence, what they do, which impacts the end result of the action. And this is a fellow, Ramzi Youssef, who was involved in the 93 World Trade Center attack. You recall that, the first attempt to attack the World Trade Center. He was deeply involved as a senior al-Qaeda operative. In the 1990s, he was part of a plot to fly a bunch of aircraft across the Pacific called the Bohinca Project, fly them across the Pacific and blow them up and kill people in midair, 11 aircraft, and then had a second phase of their project, which was to fly aircraft, Cessna aircraft, load them up with explosives and fly them to the CIA headquarters and the Pentagon. Doesn't that sound a little familiar? And later on, Air France aircraft was taken over by terrorists, and they attempted to fly it into the Eiffel Tower. The idea that aircraft could be used as missiles, or they'd be used as a system of mass destruction, is not new. But yet, on the operational side, we didn't do anything to counter the way we dealt with these things. So it's not just intelligence; it's intelligence and our policymakers working together. Some say that 9/11 was the second Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor was another intelligence failure. Those words seem to go together so easily. But here's another one. This is Norfolk, Virginia. Here's a bunch of multi-billion dollar aircraft carriers lined up waiting for attack. Now, there's no more Soviet Union to attack it. But what are we doing to operationally to make sure that we're not vulnerable? This would take out more than half of our stock of aircraft carriers. And by the way, it's July 4th. A lot of civilians would be killed as they're scrambling across the decks of these carriers. Okay, and the last bit of this, we talked about all these intelligence organizations. Well, we have a lot of strategies. We have a way to combat weapons of mass destruction. We have a homeland defense strategy, critical infrastructure, national drug control strategy, money laundering. This is getting a little confusing. National security strategy, we actually have a new one, just came out with President Obama's, combating terrorism, and the list goes on and on. And we talked about the confusion within the intelligence community when there is no single boss. The director of national intelligence is a director but doesn't have the budget or hiring or firing authority. It's much harder to implement any policy, let alone 32 policies that deal with national security. Okay, so I'm going to do a little change up here. No more myths. You might recall Father McKay, the character from MASH. He later toured the country with his co-star Jamie Farr, the Corporal Klinger, in the version of The Odd Couple, which to me is kind of sad, actually. But he did say something very interesting once. At the end of this series run, they interviewed all the actors, and they had a two-hour final episode, and someone asked him, so what was this really all about, expecting to hear this is about, you know, Vietnam? And this actor's response was, it's all about a priest in Korea. Talk about chutzpah and perspective. But I want you to have that perspective. I want you to assume that you're the president of the United States of America, and we've just discovered a new country. It looks just like us. We don't know anything about it, but we're going to do some intelligence on it. And this is the first bit of intelligence we got. This is hard intelligence. What do you think, boss? What does that tell you? Anybody have an idea what this is? By the way, this is by county. It's good. Actually, the information comes from the U.S. Census Bureau, and it's done by ancestry. And the Census Bureau doesn't look at it by race. They do it by ancestry, although one of those ancestries is African. Anyone, by the way, know what is the biggest ancestry in the U.S.? It's not African American. Mexican, that's not bad. That's going to be true pretty soon. Actually, German. All that blue up there, top of the map there, is German. But what does this map really, what does this tell you? This is the biggest population by county of an ethnic group. That population may only be 6 or 7%, right? Because it's just the plurality. It's the biggest winner. If this was a country that had parliamentary elections, that might make a little more sense. But, boss, I'm going to make this easier for you. I'm going to simplify the map, and there you are. When you look at the map, that's by state ancestry, the biggest ancestry in each U.S. state. Now, if you're looking, well, so most of the country is German? Well, sorry, boss, this is fortunately, I'm only getting this amount of information. This is all I can give you. There's a real challenge here because what you want to hear is what is the threat this country poses to America, this America too? So, boss, I can't tell you that yet. I don't have enough information. You as a policymaker have a very different perspective on what you want to hear. And I've just, you know, this is all I've gotten. By the way, you think a Jewish American would want to be in Florida? It's a German state, is it? By the way, this is really interesting. Most people are able to identify their ethnicity or their ancestry. But if you look in the middle here, these red states, they're American. They don't specify what their ancestry is. Most of them are probably German, Anglo-Irish, but that's Appalachia. And a lot of those people have been in the U.S. a long time, and they might not have a trace back to where their ancestry is. Okay, if that map is really stupid, and it is, I grant you, why do you accept this map as telling us about our country? You're seeing this map. This is actually from the 2004 election. It shows who won the election. And actually, if you look at it, it looks like the country voted red. And it did, but 48 to 51%. But why do we allow ourselves to talk about our own country with this two-dimensional picture? Let's change it up a little bit. Okay, we know where the counties are. There it is. It looks a little bit different if you do the counties. There's a lot of blue in there that wasn't there before, and there's a lot of places in California that are red. What does it mean if a county's red? It voted Republican for that election. But still, we know more than that. We know gradation, right? 20% Bush, 80% Kerry, 20% Kerry, 80% Bush. It's still not perfect, though. There's a problem here. We know what the population of America is. Using this map really distorts it. You know, last time I looked, the mountains and the deserts don't vote, right? According to this map that we've been using, they have a say. So let's put the population in there. And by the way, all these stats are coming from these maps are coming from a friend of mine at the University of Michigan. Oh, you know what? I forgot Alaska and Hawaii. That's going to change everything. This is the U.S. with the population included, right? So where the mountains and the desert are, suddenly got skinny. So let's put in Alaska and Hawaii. That'll change everything. Not too much. And then let's do the last bit, put it all together. That's the image I showed you at the top of the lecture. That's the way we need to be thinking about intelligence. It's that complex of an issue itself. But that's the level of information and need to think that I, as an intelligence officer, need to get my policymakers to think about policy issues. It's a real challenge. You think about our president, who has a lot of authority in our system, may not have much of a knowledge of the world. And even ones who do have a knowledge of the world don't have this kind of level of knowledge. So again, that's the U.S. For the 2004 election, percentage of vote by proportional and by county. But there's a problem with this map, too. If I want to talk about the election, you can't tell me anymore who won it. So your intelligence officer needs to be able to speak that language as well as the language of politics, the language that the policymaker can use. Okay, so I'm going to wrap it up, and then we'll go to Q&A. I have a couple of ideas that you might want to consider about how you might want to consider intelligence in the future. I want you to think about, is it really intelligence? Is it really about presenting facts? That is to say, presenting evidence, presenting who did what? Or is it much more complex than that? I would say that you have objective facts, those that you know of, right? There are a lot of objective facts we don't know about. But you also have to consider how you analyze those facts and how you process them. You have the mirror imaging problem. You have the fact that you're trying to do analysis on a country maybe you don't have that complex map determination on. I can tell you right now, we're still doing a lot of cultural analysis on Afghanistan. I know I teach classes on cultural analysis to military officers, and we're still trying to figure it out because every valley is a little bit different in Afghanistan. And the last bit is I go back to the needs of the policymaker. I would used to go to briefings, and I had a fellow who sat with me at these intelligence briefings where I was a consumer and he was a consumer. I was an intelligence guy. He was a ship driver. He was not intelligence, but he'd a senior guy. He'd been in the Navy for 25 years. And we'd go out of the meeting, and he'd say, why did they brief us that? They didn't tell us anything. And I said, sure they did. They told us who these guys were, what they didn't do, what they might not do, or what they could do in the future. A large part of intelligence is laying the groundwork so your bosses can know what they're looking at when they actually look at some hard facts that might be problematic when a real threat arises. And then the sort of environment we are in right now calls for us to actually do this in a systematic way. And during the Cold War, this fellow Treverton said, hey, we were looking at puzzles. You know, we were looking at mostly other countries, who was standing next to whom on the May Day Parade Wall, how many tanks, where the missiles were pointed. But now we're dealing with mysteries. You know, who hates us and who's going to attack us? That's a whole different set of understanding. Okay, and the last bit is about expectations. Consider the first part. This is a very common perception we have about intelligence. Hey, we need to predict these potential attacks because they could really hurt us. It could be very damaging. Why? Because it could be existential. During the Cold War, an attack could be wipe out the existence of both countries, maybe the Earth. The problem is that bottom part doesn't make that top part true. The fact that it's so important doesn't make the possibility of even achieving intelligence perfection even possible, because it's not. It is essentially an impossible task. And in fact, this fellow Richard Betts, who I recommend, says it's the pursuit of perfect security and the pursuit of perfect intelligence which leads us down so many rabbit holes and gets us lost. And I would say Iraq was a good example where we had imperfect intelligence and a desire for perfect security, and they came together in a very dramatic way. Okay, so last thing to consider is we're all familiar with economics. You know, economic forecasting. I'm not saying banking industry. I'm just talking about folks who work in the forecasting. They make predictions about U.S. actors and international actors, people they know they're interacting with. Most of the information is open. And then when they fail to do their jobs right, usually they say they're reckless or greedy, or someone in the business industry is reckless or greedy. And the solution, like we've seen happen recently, is, hey, you need to restructure and more regulation and recapitalize, which is essentially what we've done in regard to the banking industry. But, you know, I'm sure half of you folks are sitting around your tables are talking to your friends and saying, how long do you think, this is before the economic crisis we're in, it said, how long do you think we can keep borrowing this much money from the Chinese, or how long can we keep having negative spending? But did we act? Even when we knew that we already had one bubble and we were building up for a second bubble, did any of us act? Not enough. Not enough as did. And intelligence is very similar, except it may be more challenging. You're dealing with international actors. Sometimes you don't know who they are. The information you get on them is limited, if you can understand it. And when they fail, it's because they're reckless and incompetent. That's what we assume. And the solution's actually very similar. You reorganize and recapitalize, which I think we've done that to death with the intelligence community. Okay, so let us move on to the Q&A. Yes.
I'd like to ask if there was an official governmental entity really striving to assassinate Castro.
Well, from the reports that were done, yes. I'm not an expert on it, but I've read enough about it. I went to school here at SF State with a professor who specialized in intelligence, and he provided us all sorts of readings that were credible that suggested that, yes, we were doing that. I don't think there's that much to debate about that. But that's before my time, so I can't speak from personal knowledge, but I think that's pretty clear. Well, matter of fact, there's evidence going to the church committee investigation that we tried to assassinate Patrice Lumumba and a few other folks, but that we never actually carried out an assassination. Yes, sir.
It seems to me that the key reason for this, intelligence existing is because of the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, and it's the result in the creation of the predecessor of the CIA, and CIA is supposed to exist to, well, the DCI was supposed to exist to kind of make sure the intelligence community produced a single product that, you know, could prevent something like that happening again. Mm-hmm. Of course, as we know in history, tons of surprises that the CIA and the intelligence community just never got. I'm just wondering, is this just a function of the way the intelligence community is set up, because you've got so many different organizations and you've got to at least come up with a compromised view of things? And then also, when you come up with a view of things, it's going to be highest probability view of things, and therefore, by definition, you're never going to be looking at surprises and low probability of things with catastrophic consequences.
Yeah, I would say, though, that for Pearl Harbor, we certainly thought there was a very high probability of engagement with the Japanese Empire at some point. That was pretty sure. But that was even before, of course, we had much of an intelligence agency. I think the challenge is, one of the challenges you brought up, the fact that low-density issues don't tend to get looked at that closely is an issue. But it's also the fact you have to coordinate with so many different agencies who have different uses for intelligence. That's part of the problem. And there's, despite the fact we have a director of national intelligence, he isn't that in name only. The current director is leaving after, you know, less than a year and a half in office, a four-star admiral, because I think he finds the job frustrating. And because you don't really control the things you're going to be responsible for. So part of it's that way, but you can't do it any other way. You can't have all of them report to, one person, and that would be the president, I guess. It's not going to work that way. You want the intelligence people to provide intelligence that suits the needs of the agency. You want the FBI to have a very different kind of intelligence for their needs, as opposed to the Department of Energy, which is looking for a very different type of intelligence. So there's sort of a tension between those things. But I think there's a lot of things that probably we know that happened that they just don't have the same impact. For example, the Millennium attack was an attack that was going to happen in 1999, just before the turn of the millennium. A fellow was arrested at the Canadian border, and he had a very succinct plan and explosives to bomb the L.A. airport. But, you know, half you guys going, really? When did that happen? Well, it didn't happen. That's why the things that do happen are stick in your head, and they're either failure because we didn't predict them, or the things that we had a successful takedown just don't have the same impact. And for the vast majority of Americans, it's a day in the news and it's gone. And I'm not here to defend the intelligence community. I want to put out ideas about it. But I think that the facts are a little more nuanced than you're going to get from Tim Weiner's book, for example, on the CIA, where he won all these awards for essentially cherry picking the facts to suit his ambition. At least that's my take on it. Yes, sir.
I was wondering if you could comment on the politicization of intelligence, and I was thinking mainly of the the national intelligence. Can you hear me? National intelligence estimate of the when Iran could get the bomb that kind of came out with a big change a couple 3 years ago. Is this something that's considered a growing problem by the intelligence community, or is this something that's been there all along and we're just finding out about it now?
I think it's been there all along. I don't think it's that severe. I mean, I worked at fairly senior levels, and no one ever pressured me to come up with, you know, politicized intelligence. But I think it's an issue. For example, agencies, you know, they have a particular goal in mind. They have their own agendas, and quite often I think that might color how they view things. But I don't think it's the overall overriding factor that determines intelligence. I think mostly intelligence is determined by the analysts working with the data they have. So I think it's an issue. I think what we have a sort of a problem is we'd like to see certain things show up in our national security realm. During the Cold War, as a country, those involved in national security wanted to see the Soviet Union being a big threat because that made it easier for us to gin up support to counter it, to balance it. So that no doubt influenced our thinking. For a decade and a half, you couldn't say enough bad things about Iraq's Saddam Hussein's Iraq. I mean, the more bad things you said about it, generally the better you did. I don't think that was like politicized, or at least not before President Cheney and Vice President Cheney got involved. I think it was a sort of a meme. You know, it's a touchstone. You simply had to conform to that sort of level of understanding, or you know, sort of suffer the fate of being a Sodom lover. So there's a couple different things going on there. And sometimes it's very politicized. But I think those are really rare, and I'm not sure if there's anyone in the room who has a case they could bring up. But I didn't see it at the time I was there.
How does our intelligence compare both efficacy-wise and methodology-wise with two countries that are known to have extremely sophisticated intelligence, Israel and Russia?
Well, that's a good question. In the case of Israel, I think you could make a claim that there was bad intelligence the other day that led them to raid the flotilla. They're not looking as good. it could be either one. It could have also been bad intelligence. They might have intelligence saying that there was arms on board. But I don't think they're giants either. I think they're very good. They're probably the best in some ways, in a lot of ways, particularly human intelligence in the Middle East. But for them, it's very, very clearly existential. You know, 9/11 was terrible, but it's not existential for the U.S., right? I mean, the worst part about 9/11, other than the direct deaths of 3,000 Americans, was our reaction to it, which has led to more than 4,000 dead Americans and those of us who wore a uniform, and the spending of trillions of dollars. So, but back to your point, I don't know. I think we sort of paint the Israelis as 10 feet tall, but there's plenty of cases where they've had some problems. You know, their revenge against Black September ended when they killed the wrong guy in Norway. They had the recent killing in Dubai, where it was all tracked on videotape. But that's covert. That's covert operations. I also say that 1973 war was totally missed by the Israelis. They thought it was not going to happen. And this is a really good lesson case. There's a guy named Caldwell wrote an article in the New York Times not too many months ago. You could look up, and he talks about intelligence. And he says, in the case of the Israelis, you look at all the information that they had in front of them. They had remember their enemies at that time were Egypt and Syria and Jordan, mostly Syria and Egypt. And they saw this buildup of the military on both countries. They saw Russians, advisors sending their kids home on airplanes and their dependents home, so it was just the main staff. And then you saw cancellation of leave. You saw bridging activity. And this sounds like they should have really been ready for the 73 war. Why did they not respond to it? Because they'd seen this five or six times before, and had ginned up every time and realized it was just a feint, a trick they were being played upon them to make them waste their resources. Except this time, it turned out to be true. So I think the U.S. has a pretty good intelligence. It's just expectations are much too high. They simply can't provide the perfect intelligence or perfect security. Part of the problem is we tend to invite attacks upon ourselves and are surprised when they happen. I would suggest that some of the attacks we've seen in recent years in the U.S. or attempted attacks, and one of the ones we're going to see in the future, are people who are motivated by long occupation of Iraq. And you didn't see it on the U.S. news, but you can believe that a lot of folks in the Arab world and the Muslim world saw day after day U.S. troops going into people's homes and roughing them up and making enemies. And those folks will come back to bite us. As far as Israelis, I think they are exceptional, but I don't think any intelligence service is great. As far as the Russians, it depends on who's in charge. If Stalin's in charge and the Germans are massing on your border and you don't do anything, I would give you an F for that. Sir?
What do you think are the chances that there are moles like Aldrich Ames or Robert Hansen currently in the U.S. intelligence community, and to what extent is this a threat that people are currently concerned about?
You know, that's actually a sort of a minor task with intelligence, you know, called counterintelligence. And I just don't have any experience. I'd be surprised if there weren't, but it's a different environment now. Think about it. Maybe there are folks who might have a religious motivation. There might be some moles of that type. But also think about it, if you're a person who could be turned, if you're a corrupt person or you have some personal problems and you're not motivated by some ideology, like communism or something, and you're turned by a country that's friendly to the U.S. Or somewhat non-hostile, maybe it'd be easier for that person to turn because, it's, you know, yeah, I'm giving them stuff, I'm getting money, no one's getting hurt. So that, in my mind, we're looking at somewhat a different type of counterintelligence threat. But I really can't give you any kind of feel for it. I apologize if you want to ask it. But another question, I'll try to get better for you. Norma.
What are your thoughts on whether we might be giving too much emphasis to dangers in the air and airlines as opposed to other types of dangers and other forms of transportation?
Well, we've seen how the Al-Qaeda folks are able to think asymmetrically. So, for example, we have this multi-billion-dollar military, and they were able to do essentially a missile attack using aircraft by getting around our defenses, by getting inside our defenses and knowing how to do it. So, yes, I could see that maybe we are emphasizing too much, but there's a lot of bang for your buck, excuse the term, for aircraft because it's very visible. For example, on the sea, you might be able to get images of a ship burning. But it's just not the same kind of impact as an aircraft flying into a building. But your point's well taken. By the way, before we were attacked in 9/11, we were attacked on the ground at embassies in Africa. On the sea, the USS Cole in 2000. And then in 2001 by the air. Why are we surprised? Sir.
Can you comment, please, on the internet and intelligence, how this is changing the intelligence? Is working for intelligence now basically reading blogs and so on, or is there more than this?
Well, that's a pretty good question. I haven't answered that question before, and let me consider it. There was actually a debate I heard the other day on whether internet's good for democracy or bad for it, and I'm not sure how I come down on that. There's a lot you can get from open source intelligence. You can learn a lot about countries and cultures. That's very operationally useful. Maybe not be able to plan some kind of response, but in understanding other societies. So in that sense, it's definitely very useful. You think about it in the terms of intelligence agencies, what they can do, there's a lot we can do. We can listen from all sorts of places. But there's a lot of things you can't do, and you can't go up to a world leader and ask them questions about what he thinks about this and that. But if you remember the press, you can. So we rely upon the press for that sort of thing. So why not other press too? My concern with the internet at this stage is that we're sort of getting rid of the editorial process in news, and so people are, you know, you're getting your pundit giving you their view of something without any information backing them up, without any sort of hard process of reviewing it. So you suddenly, something looks like it might be true and doesn't have that editorial process that you find in the New York Times, LA Times, or even on Fox News. They have an editorial process too. So I would say that it's sort of a mixed blessing. Certainly, we found that some of the states who are hostile towards the internet are the ones who also don't like human rights and democracy. So they feel threatened by the internet. So that kind of makes me feel good that an open society is probably a better one.
What do you think about the post-9/11 efforts that were done to centralize the intelligence gathering and the connectivity between the different members of the intelligence community, and how effective do you think that has been? Do you think more restructuring is warranted, particularly in light of the recent changes at DNI?
Hmm. Yeah, I think at this point, any more restructuring is just going to be counterproductive unless it really fixes broken things. And that's my sort of theme here is... You just can't really fix some of the issues. You simply can't make an FBI intelligence analyst do the job of an Air Force intelligence analyst or a CIA intelligence analyst. You need to have these folks having their own products providing themselves. The interconnective tissue, the better we can do that, obviously, the farther it goes. But we've even seen, again, you know, with the underwear bomber, you know, hey, we got him. This is my son. He's crazy. He's on a no-fly list. He's not on a no-fly list. Well, that's not intelligence. That gets to the procedural problem. And I think that's the one area we still need to fix is hooking up intelligence with procedure. Those are folks who execute policy. And it's problematic in our society. It's always going to be problematic because you don't want to be the mailman who collects intelligence. You don't want to be the State Department fellow who actually works for the State Department and has to provide intelligence. You don't want to be the person who's providing health care and also providing intelligence. And that would be one way we could fix that broken link. And I don't think we're a society we want to go down that way. I don't want to see that.
I was going to ask a question about the State Department's Intelligence Bureau, and it has this reputation for having the best kind of analytical capacity, or at least predictive capacity. I was going to ask whether or not that's well-deserved, and then you kind of just answered the second part of my question, which was going to kind of get into whether or not the classic alternative proposal of separating analysis from collection had any merit, but I think you just kind of stated your opinion on that one. But the first part is still a valid question, I think.
Oh, that's great. That is a great question. I could have asked myself that question because the State Department has by far the best political analysis. And there's a couple of reasons for it. They have very sharp people. The State Department is really selective. They have a very focused job in their intelligence. They don't have a lot of other things to distract them. People tend to know their regions pretty well. They're small and they're able to communicate. So when someone has a real issue with someone's analysis, they're able to communicate it directly and they resolve it at that level. So state INR, Intelligence and Research Bureau, is really good. I've always been impressed with them, and they've been right much more than anyone else. We answered the other part. Is that John?
Well, I'm happy to hear your remarks about the State Department because I was a political analyst for a few months, eons ago. The question had been raised, what about moles? Would you consider Colonel Franklin, who worked for Douglas Feith in the Department of Defense and was a spy for Israel, an example of a mole? But then going on to another matter, how would you advise honest intelligence officers when the politicians want to cook the books, as we learned from the Downing Street memo, when Bush told Blair we're going to cook the books so that we can invade Iraq. And this special office of special plans was set up with neocons in the Department of Defense to provide the intelligence which the CIA would not provide.
Yeah, your read is essentially my read of that, how those events happened. You have to stand up or get fired. You have to fall on your sword. And we don't see this happening at all. There's a fellow, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Yinling, who was, I think he's a colonel now, was an Air Force, an Army officer. He wrote a scathing critique, maybe that's why he didn't get promoted, about generals not standing up or falling on their swords. That is to say, not saying, hey, boss, this is the way it is. This is the way I see it. If you don't like that, I need to quit because I can't support their policy. And we haven't seen much of that. We didn't see much of that happening in the intelligence community, which is surprised me, because I clearly believe that the what we're getting out of Iraq was just absolute garbage. General Powell's speech, I could write a book. Every point he made was an exaggeration, duplicitous. It's just, and it's a guy I admire. I've worked with him. He's a very smart, moderate guy. But I think with his case, he said, I tell you what, you're not planning to go to the UN to do this. Let me take it to the UN. So there are cases where people cut a deal, and I think that's how they fell on the sword, because he certainly lost a lot of respect to people. But the problem is that people just aren't doing that. People in anywhere in government, or in general. Well, this is Governor Blagojevich in Illinois. He's a national hero, reality TV and talk shows. And the guy hasn't been convicted of a crime yet, but doesn't mean we make him a hero. We seem to have lost that ability to really have people responsible for their actions, and it's an intelligence community too. I would agree. I was teaching when the Iraq War was coming about, and I knew all of it was just bunk. I had no access to intelligence at that point. The Iraqis just were not interested in helping out Al Qaeda. They had one thing in mind, and that's keeping Saddam Hussein and company in power. That's all they really cared about. Remember, they had been allied with us before they were against us. And the fact that a country has WMD doesn't mean we have to invade them. Syria has had all sorts of WMD for years. A lot of countries have WMD, Libya, and most of them are just not a concern. And I think a lot of Americans, maybe people in this room, assume that WMD meant some sort of, a threat to the U.S. or a threat to as a terrorist weapon. Most of the things that we talked about that maybe having were just not a serious threat. They'd never had any nuclear capability. No one ever said they've got a nuclear capability or a nuclear bomb. And all the other threats are just much, much less. Frank.
Yeah, Paul, you made a very good point that when I was working with the Department of State, the enemy was the Soviet Union. We were in the Cold War. I retired 2 months before the Berlin Wall came down. And now the main adversary has changed. It's whatever you want to call it, Islamist extremism, terrorism, whatever. You pointed out that we were rather single-minded about the Cold War, a political standpoint, economic standpoint, military standpoint. I don't have the feeling that we are that single-minded or that a discipline has been created to deal with terrorism. I think part of this may be due to the distractions of the Iraq War and of the Afghan War. And you've mentioned the State Department's superior analytical capabilities, and John has mentioned what excellent work they do in political reporting. But their mission has obviously expanded, and I wonder if they're aware of it. If you look at the analysis of the failures on the Detroit fellow with Abdul Muttalib, if I have that name correct, the State Department failed to pick up indicators from his parents and from his visa application and the travel he had taken that should have been put in the mix immediately. And I wonder if other agencies have also perhaps not quite figured out what their mission is in approaching this essentially human target, in changing from puzzles to mysteries, as you put it?
Well, you brought up a couple points. One, I'll address that Norma sort of talked about, is that we're focused on air travel. And as soon as we figure out the best way to keep that safe, they're going to find another avenue, right? There's no sense them hitting a wall. Why spend the time doing that when they can find other ways where we're weak? It's simply a lot easier to bring things in through freighting, through ships. I look at all the freight ships that come through the Golden Gate Bridge, Golden Gate every day. The other bit was the fact that we still don't really have a grand strategy to deal with this issue of, and even with the national security strategy, we have an operational strategy. But how do we address the issue where we're no longer inviting ourselves to be attacked? And part of the problem is, I think we had, you know, if you think about the resources a state has, you know, they has diplomatic, military, informational, economic. Well, the military is, you know, it's very competent now, but it's also overstretched. Economic, we've already invested the money we're going to invest in this issue. We spend trillions of dollars already. We just don't have more money to do a grand strategy, for example, attacking root causes. It's not even talked about. So I think what we have is what we're going to get. And part of the problem is we still haven't figured out why are we being attacked, and we don't have a common idea on that.
Yes, could you please address the relative danger of a dirty bomb attack and a major cyber liability attack? How realistic is that fear?
Those two things, right? Mm-hmm. A dirty bomb is achievable. But the technology is really not that easy to, you know, a common terrorist group to put together. It could be done. I think what you'd probably get more likely would be a faux dirty bomb. That is, they have the radiological material. They're not able to disperse it well enough, but they'll have a kinetic explosion, and they'll have a radiological release, and that will have the response that equivalent to a dirty bomb. A dirty bomb is not a nuclear bomb. It has radiological material that's dispersed, but it's not particularly a weapon that's been used. So there's not a lot of the technologies out there are kind of minimal. Not much is required, but I don't think the skill set's there. Again, so a sort of faux dirty bomb, where someone tries to make it look like that, and we would respond disproportionately, that's a real possibility. I don't have any information that that's going to happen. Cyber warfare, we're already in cyber warfare. It's happening every day, all the time. People, countries, it's just everywhere all the time. It's very disconcerting because I don't think we quite understand it.
Unfortunately, we have time for one more question.
If you could be any kind of animal, what kind of animal?
I got a question.
Oh, sorry.
Where do you come down on the issue of whether the kinds of attacks that we've seen and the kinds of terrorism we've seen should be treated as from a criminal standpoint versus an intelligence, military, a war standpoint?
Well, that's great. It's definitely something that the current administration's struggling with, and they seem to be trying to figure out what's the best approach legally. All I can say is we started off on pretty poor footing. The idea that we could practice some of these torture techniques and expect to get good results, I think it's just a disaster. So basically anywhere we go is going to be good. It's good from there. But I think we have to pursue it in a way that's, you know, generally going to be for our best national security interests. And I think most of the time you can still square that with providing full legal rights to persons who are apprehended. There may be exceptions. I'd be willing to glad to entertain them, but they're very few and far between. The whole idea of a ticking time bomb, where you need to put pressure on somebody to get a response, it just hasn't played out in history. It hasn't played out in our history. Israelis who had the experience of multiple attacks on populations just never actually had that situation come up. So, generally thinking that using those aggressive techniques or are generally cost us a lot more than a gain. Now, you torture one gentleman who's Arabic or Muslim, you know, if you've tortured them all, then it's sort of we're into the business of torturing Muslims. We're in the business of torturing Arabs. That's what it looks like to outside observers, and that can't be good for us. That doesn't get us anything. So I hope I did answer your question.
Our thanks to Paul Clark, educator and retired U.S. Air Force intelligence officer, for his most informative presentation. And thanks to our audience here and on the radio. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating its second century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.